Palestinian prisoners in the jail.
Thank you, Amy. Look, I think it's important for people to understand that Israel has arrested somewhere up to the tune of 21,000 Palestinians. We don't actually even have the correct number because that information has been held back. And of these thousands of people who have been imprisoned, they've been imprisoned without charge, without trial, and in effect, kidnapped. The people who have been released, and I've spoken to a number of them, all of them have been reporting the exact same treatment of extreme abuse, of torture, of being shackled 24 hours a day, of being kept in a fetal position, of being forced to eat food that is inhumane, of being deprived water, of being, many of them have talked about being raped, of being electric shocked, of sleep deprivation, you name it. And the people with whom I've spoken are young, some of them are teenagers, and some of them are older. And the stories that are coming out from these prisoners is absolutely appalling. The fact that Israel can continue to do this with impunity is what is so alarming, because nobody has been holding back. In fact, it's quite the opposite. We have the minister, the Israeli minister, who is in charge of the prisons, who has come out and said very unequivocally that the way that we can deal with overcrowding in prisons is to institute the death penalty. He himself has been reported as being one of the individuals who carried out torture against Palestinians who've been kidnapped. And so the situation that we hear of these people who've been coming out of Sde Tamim, by the way, Palestinians call it the slaughterhouse, is absolutely horrifying. Now, what happened on Monday was that for some reason, we're not entirely sure why, there was an attempt on the part of the Israeli military to try to question, and that's it, just question, 9 members of the Israeli army who are accused of gang raping one Palestinian man. And rather than people backing the military police or saying, we don't want this done, it was quite the opposite. We ended up seeing 2 riots, one in the actual prison camp itself. It's a torture camp called Sde Tamim, and another one in another military base where there were not just rioters, but people who are members of the Knesset, including members of the cabinet, who came forward and said that these people are heroes and that there should be no restraints put whatsoever on Israeli soldiers. So the picture that is coming out is quite dire, and of course, nobody's doing anything about it.
Ohren Zeev, you're a reporter and photographer for 972 Magazine. You have a piece out just today headlined, A Riot for Impunity Shows Israel's Proud Embrace of Its Crimes. If you could lay out your argument, you write that far-right protesters, soldiers, and MKs, that is members of the Knesset, rallied for guards suspected of raping a Palestinian detainee. Once fringe, they are now the public face of the state. If you could elaborate.
Thank you for having me. It's important to notice that while the Israeli media try to portray it as a struggle between the mob and the state, or between the army and the police, that was not preventing this riot, although requested, I think it's important to see that today, because Ben-Gvir and their allies are in the government and are leading those demonstrations, including breaking into Sde Tamim, they are the face of the state. And those people are not extremists. They're the mainstream Israelis nowadays. In that sense, their sense of anger and surprise can be understood, because from the beginning of the war, since October, there was full or almost full impunity for soldiers. So we still don't know why this specific case was investigated and is being proceeded. But we, as Diana said, we're hearing many horrific evidence from prisoners that were released to Gaza, to the West Bank, or into 48 Israel. And it's not a unique case. So from the protester side, they understood, and the soldier, as we published in different investigation, the soldiers on the ground understood they have full impunity. They were looting, they were killing, they were shooting from the sky, from the ground. And the Israeli public got the sense from the politicians declaring, but also just from the day-to-day war, that soldiers are allowed to do whatever they want. And when an incident like this comes, a very rare incident, that the military police is coming and arresting or detaining a few soldiers for questioning and might take them to court, people are angry, because they believe that the Israeli military is allowed and have a backup to do anything. And this also shows us how Israel got to the ICC and to the ICJ with this kind of approach.
Oren, you were at Bitlid Army base on Monday where the protests were taking place. Explain where that is and where Tzeteman is, these two jails, prisons.
Tzeteman is an army base near Beersheba in southern Israel. And Bitlid, where they were held, questioned, and later also brought to a military court, is between in central Israel, not far so from the West Bank town of Tul Karem. So the protests on Monday started at Tzeteman with members of the government breaking into the place. And later, when they understood the soldiers were transferred to Bitlid army base, to the military court and detention center, they moved there. Also there, a member of the government and of the Knesset arrived and were inciting against the army. And also there are hundreds of people breaking into the military compound. And at the protest, you could see also armed men with uniform and military weapons, probably soldiers, reservist soldiers that are friends or colleagues of the soldiers arrested. And they were protesting against the army with the army uniform and weapons. And this is a very common for Palestinians and activists in the West Bank when you have soldiers that are actually settlers or a mixture of that. But inside Israel, since the beginning of the war, we haven't seen much of that, of this kind of militias operating. And there were, of course, also masks. And in general, towards them, but towards also the people who were breaking into the army base, the police was doing absolutely nothing. As we learned later, the police was just, despite the fact the army was calling for the police, they just didn't show up. And the few policemen that were there were not doing much. I think it's important to see that this is kind of a struggle between the old establishment, maybe the center left or the old people in the army that, you know, believe that Israel has to have some legal framework, like to do the crime towards Palestinian, but to keep them proportional and something to investigate, to have some illusion or to present that Israel is investigating itself. And the other side is people like Ben-Gvir and his their allies that think that soldiers who had full impunity and also are proud in their crimes, in their attacks against Palestinians, and they document it on social media, as we've seen. And this is kind of the clash that is happening in the moment.
And Diana, could you explain, you spoke to a young man named Bilal who described what he called engineered torture methods that were designed to break Palestinians.
Yes, what he talked to me about was that everything that was done was not, you know, people often think of torture, and by the way, it should never be used, but people often think of torture as a means to try to extract information, and even then it's illegal. But in this case, it wasn't at all designed to extract information. It was just as a form of eternal punishment to show who is supreme. So he talked about how his hands and his legs were shackled, that there was a circle that was drawn around him with his eyes blindfolded and kept in a fetal position for 24 hours a day, that if he moved outside of the chalk, that he would be tortured. But it wasn't just that. It wasn't just him being tortured. He was then forced to witness other people being tortured as well. So he himself, the only time the blindfold was removed was to see other people being tortured, other people being raped. He also talked to me about how the small quantities of food that were being given to them, so much so that he got to the point where he was looking to see exactly how many calories were written on the various containers that he was given, because the whole point was to try to control how much food they were taking in. He ended up losing a substantial amount of weight while being held in prison and is still undergoing very serious health problems because he was not allowed to use the bathroom for a number for about 60 days. He also talked about how all of the prisoners who've emerged, all of these kidnapped people, have scabies on them. They were denied the ability to take showers, and they were denied the ability to have even drinking water. So all of this, he said, was just as a means of showing who it is who is boss. They weren't at all doing torture to extract information. Again, that is illegal and should not be conducted. But in this case, it was a question of exerting one's superiority over them. They were told that they must understand that Israel is superior and that Israel can exact revenge anytime it wants.
This is Dr. Mohammed Abu Sameha, the director of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza, who himself was jailed by Israel for 7 months without charge.
We were subjected to severe torture and my little finger was broken. I was repeatedly subjected to hitting on the head, causing bleeding multiple times. There was almost daily torture in the Israeli prisons. When prisoners' cells were raided daily, they were severely beaten every day. We say this with full certainty, and we lived through it with great bitterness. Colleagues working in the Ministry of Health and other prisoners got out with us today. About 50 prisoners. We left behind many prisoners, tens of thousands of prisoners, living in hardship, experiencing psychological and physical torture that no Palestinian prisoner has experienced since the Nakba in 1948. Our brave prisoners are subjected to all kinds of tortures behind bars. Even the older prisoners, who have spent tens of years in the occupation prisons, have been deprived of all of their most basic rights. Many prisoners have died while they were in interrogation and were deprived of medicine and food.
Again, that's Dr. Mohammed Abu Sameha, the director of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza, who himself was jailed by Israel for 7 months, only recently released. And then you have Palestinian attorney Khaled Mahajna, who was the first lawyer to visit Sde Teman. He said the situation there is more horrific than anything we've heard about Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. We hear about people losing their limbs because they were handcuffed so tightly for so long. Diana Butu, as we wrap up, your final comment about what's happening and where the investigations are going for this and who is being held accountable.
This is a concentration camp, is a torture camp where, as Khaled has already mentioned, we've seen that people have had their limbs chopped off, oftentimes without anesthesia, by the way, where all segments of society are now complicit in this. And the fact that we don't see any investigations or even a push for investigations inside Israel, but to the contrary, we see people who are pushing for the right to be able to torture and rape, it shows you exactly where Israeli society is. And it shows you that there's a failure on the part of the international system to hold Israel accountable.
Diana Butu, I want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian human rights attorney, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization. We'll link to your piece on Zateo, rioting for the right to rape Palestinians. And I spoke to Palestinians tortured by Israel. What they endured is unimaginable. And we want to thank Oren Zeev, reporter and photographer for 972 magazine. His latest article is headlined, "A Riot for Impunity Shows Israel's Proud Embrace of Its Crimes." Coming up, Donald Trump questioned by three black women reporters at the National Association of Black Journalists annual convention. You must hear this. The Deltron 3030 Instrumental Memory Loss. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump appeared before the annual convention of the National Association of Black Journalists in Chicago on Wednesday for a sit-down interview with a panel of black women journalists. The association's decision to invite Trump had sparked outrage within the organization. On Tuesday, Washington Post editor Karen Attias stepped down as co-chair of the NABJ's convention.
During the interview, Trump repeatedly sparred with the reporters, insulted them, and also questioned whether Kamala Harris is actually black. He claimed he was the best president for the black population since Abraham Lincoln. We turn now to excerpts from this interview with Fox News host Harris Faulkner, Semaphore's Khadija Gobba, and ABC News' Rachel Scott, who began the event with this question.
I want to start by addressing the elephant in the room, sir. A lot of people did not think it was appropriate for you to be here today. You have pushed false claims about some of your rivals, from Nikki Haley to former President Barack Obama, saying that they were not born in the United States, which is not true. You have told four congresswomen of color who were American citizens to go back to where they came from. You have used words like animal and rabid to describe black district attorneys. You've attacked black journalists, calling them a loser, saying the questions that they ask are, quote, stupid and racist. You've had dinner with a white supremacist at your Mar-a-Lago resort. So my question, sir, now that you are asking black supporters to vote for you, why should black voters trust you after you have used language like that?
Well, first of all, I don't think I've ever been asked a question so in such a horrible manner, a first question. You don't even say, hello, how are you? Are you with ABC? Because I think they're a fake news network, a terrible network. And I think it's disgraceful that I came here in good spirit. I love the black population of this country. I've done so much for the black population of this country. I was invited here, and I was told my opponent, whether it was Biden or Kamala, I was told my opponent was going to be here. It turned out my opponent isn't here. You invited me under false pretense. And then you said, you can't do it with Zoom. Well, you know, where's Zoom? She's going to do it with Zoom, and she's not coming. And then you were half an hour late. Just so we understand, I have too much respect for you to be late. They couldn't get their equipment working or something
Mr.
was
President,
wrong.
Mr. President, I would love
I think
you
it's
can
a
answer
very
the question
nasty
on your
question.
Rhetoric
well,
and why
I,
you believe
I have answered
black
the question.
Trust you with another
I have
years.
Been the best president for the black population since Abraham Lincoln.
Better
That's
than,
my answer.
Better than President Johnson who signed
answer.
The Voting Rights
and
Act.
For you to start off a question and answer period, especially when you're 35 minutes late because you couldn't get your equipment to work, in such a hostile manner, I think it's a disgrace. I
let
really
me,
do
let me just ask a follow-up, sir, and then we'll move on to other questions here. Some of your own supporters, including Republicans on Capitol Hill, have labeled Vice President Kamala Harris, who is the first black and Asian American woman to serve as vice president and be on a major party ticket, as a DEI hire. Is that acceptable language to you? And will you tell those Republicans and those supporters to stop it?
How do you define DEI? Go ahead. How do you define
diversity, equity, inclusion?
Okay, yeah, go ahead. Is that what your definition?
Give that me, is that that is.
Give me a definition
the
then. Would you give me a definition
DEI.
Of that? Give me a definition.
Sir,
of
I'm
that.
Asking you a question.
No, no,
a
you
very
have to define
question.
It. Define it for me, if you
I
would.
Just defined it, sir. Do you believe that Vice President Kamala Harris is only on the ticket because she is a black woman?
Well, I can say no. I think it's maybe a little bit different. So, I've known her a long time indirectly, not directly, very much, and she was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she black?
She has always
but
identified
you know
as a black woman.
I respect
she went to a historically
either
black
one.
College.
I respect either one, but she obviously doesn't, because she was Indian all the way, and then all of a sudden she made a turn, and she became a black person.
Just to be
as you were coming today, we really got to see that we are divided along the lines of race, along the lines of gender. And there is this question of, in this moment where we are, why come here? What is your message today?
My message is to stop people from invading our country that are taking, frankly, a lot of problems with it, but one of the big problems, and a lot of the journalists in this room I know and I have great respect for, a lot of the journalists in this room are black. I will tell you that coming from the border are millions and millions of people that happen to be taking black jobs. You had the best.
What exactly is a black job, sir?
A black job is anybody that has a job. That's what it is. Anybody that has a job.
All right.
So, Sadia Massey, someone from Illinois, an unarmed black woman, was shot the other day in her home by a deputy sheriff. The deputy has since been charged with murder. You said police would get immunity from prosecution if you win. Why should someone like that officer have immunity, in your opinion?
Immunity?
Immunity.
I don't know the exact case, but I saw something And it didn't look good to me. It didn't look good to me. Are you talking with the water, right?
Yeah, well, police unions are not backing this person either. Okay. But again,
They're going to be charging the officer. I guess they're charging the officer.
So why should he receive immunity?
Well, he might not. I mean, it depends. It depends on what happens.
That's presidential nominee Donald Trump being interviewed at the National Association of Black Journalists annual convention in Chicago. He was questioned by Fox News host Harris Faulkner, Semaphore's Khadija Gobba, and ABC News' Rachel Scott. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show looking at a major new Washington Post expose titled Money War, How Four U.S. Presidents Unleashed Economic Warfare Across the Globe. The Post reporting examines how the U.S. has increasingly relied on economic sanctions that have left collateral damage across the globe. The Post expose begins saying, quote, today, the United States imposes three times as many sanctions as any other country or international body, targeting a third of all nations with some kind of financial penalty on people, properties, or organizations.
But the collateral damage of the sanctions is seldom discussed. The Washington Post reports in Venezuela, which just held a contested election, sanctions have contributed to an economic contraction roughly three times as large as that caused by the Great Depression in the United States. The Post also reports Donald Trump was warned sanctions on Venezuela could result in millions of people migrating from Venezuela. We're joined now by Jeff Stein, co-author of the Washington Post expose and White House economics reporter for the Post. Why don't you take it from there, Jeff? In this 5 minutes that we have together, talk about making the Venezuelan economy scream. We'll go from the effect of sanctions on Venezuela and then go to other countries.
Yeah, so starting under the Obama administration, the U.S. began imposing sanctions on Venezuela, but at first they were very limited. They were really just focused on a few members of the Maduro regime that were responsible for carrying out violent reprisals against protesters in Venezuela. But really under Trump, and as we exclusively reported in this story, despite the warnings of DHS officials and classified reports about the potential outmigration effects of these sanctions, the Trump administration really choked off the main source of export revenue. 96% of Venezuela's export revenue comes from oil sales. And what the U.S. effectively did over the course of 3 to 4 years was to block those sales from occurring in international markets. And that really strangled the joint ventures that were sort of the lifeblood of the Venezuelan economy. This means sort of the oil deals that were worked out with U.S. producers, with the Venezuelans that were providing them with the revenue that they needed to buy sort of imports from other countries. And when that happened, you saw, as the numbers are just staggering, 71% economic contraction in Venezuela, as you mentioned, three times as great as the U.S. Great Depression and greater than any other peacetime economic collapse recorded in modern history, greater than many other economic collapses of countries at war, including Ukraine in after the Russian invasion or Iraq after the U.S. invasion in 2003. So this is a cataclysmic event. And economists go back and forth, and it seems clear to me from my reporting that the economic collapse in Venezuela predates U.S. sanctions. Venezuela had inflation of over 800% before Trump really tightened the screws on the Venezuelan economy. But there is also no doubt that these U.S. measures made the economic situation in Venezuela worse. And at the cost of despite that cost, did not push out Maduro's government, and obviously Maduro still remains in power today.
So can you say, Jeff, this is Venezuela's case, but also elsewhere, how effective have U.S. economic sanctions been? I mean, there was a time, which you point out in the piece, with apartheid South Africa, sanctions helped bring down end apartheid. Also in Serbia, the demise of Milosevic's regime, also through sanctions or partially through sanctions. But what about now?
Now, I think it's really hard to say. Academic attempts to sort of isolate the effects of sanctions and whether they have worked or not are very hard to quantify. Some studies I've seen suggest that the success rate is between 15 and 30%, which, given that we have sanctions now in some form on roughly a third of all nations and 60% of all poor countries, suggests a very high failure rate. We look in the piece at Cuba, Iran, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, Afghanistan, Syria. These are tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people who are being affected in some form by U.S. sanctions, where the regimes that the U.S. are intending to target have not changed hands, have not surrendered their hold on power. And maybe, you know, the U.S. will say that these sanctions are still better than not having any measures because they deprive these regimes of funds at their disposal that they can use for, you know, what the U.S. would say are pernicious activities, activities that the U.S. does not want to see. But at the same time, in terms of actually leading to changes of regime, we don't really see that very much. And many critics will argue that, in fact, sanctions actually embolden and empower the people in charge, these regimes in charge, because they curb civil society, they reduce the power and the clout of private sector actors that often form a rival power base to the sanctioned authority that these regimes in charge. And so in case after case, we see very legitimate, it seems, criticisms of these sanctions regimes.
And what about Iran, to say the least, very much in the news today, the effect of the U.S. sanctions, and also how when the U.S. imposes sanctions, they also pressure other countries to do the same, of course, as we see in Cuba.
Yeah, the Iran sanctions really first imposed in really dramatic effect in 2010 through measures passed by the Obama administration and Congress really amounted to a fascinating expansion of U.S. sanction authority, where we really saw in a very significant way the first deployment of secondary sanctions, which were to say we're not just sanctioning the party that we don't like here, but we're also going to say if you engage with measure in trade with the Iranian regime, we will target you. And so that effectively represented a major expansion of sanctioning power and really seemed to the advocates of sanctions to be a very effective approach because, obviously, in 2015, the Obama administration worked with the Iranian regime on a nuclear deal that sanctions advocates hailed as the product of this pressure campaign. That said, the U.S. under Trump, you know, pulled out of that deal. And so any people who say that the Iranian sanctions under Obama were successful have to contend with the fact that we abandoned as a country that deal quite quickly and left the Iranians in the lurch and have since then seen the Iranians work with Russia, work with, the Cubans, work with other powers that the U.S. is opposed to on forming rival financial networks that leave open the question of whether there's even the possibility of further Iran sanctions being effective now that they've formed all these rival sort of trading networks that operate sort of as a shadow trade system to what the U.S., the sort of Western financial system that is the predicate for punishing Iran via sanctions.
And Jeff, very quickly, we have 30 seconds. What happened to the 2021 plan to overhaul the U.S. sanction system?
Yeah, we exclusively report in our story that a group of Treasury staffers had a draft of a report far more extensive than what they ultimately released. They had dozens of recommendations, including measures really meant to check the rise of U.S. sanctions, particularly a sort of central coordinator. Right now, it's a little bureaucratic, but there are sort of many parts of the government that sort of throw out sanctions ideas. They get rolled together in State Department and Treasury Department sanctions and push forward. And there's really no one body that sort of is evaluating whether these sanctions are operating in the context of an overall broader sanction strategy. And Treasury staffers drew up a plan to say, like, let's put that in place. But disagreements with the State Department, sort of the overall inertia of sanctions, where they seem so easy, so effective, they seem to the U.S. government much easier than going to war, much easier than doing nothing, or much more politically palatable than doing nothing. And so that plan was shelved, and really under the Biden administration, we've just seen more and more sanctions. Biden has imposed 6,000 sanctions in 2 years, an unprecedented sum. And the fact that has continued really reflects the inability of the U.S. to get this problem or to get this number down.
Jeff Stein, we thank you so much for being with us. Reporter for The Washington Post will link to your piece, How Four U.S. Presidents Unleashed Economic Warfare Across the Globe. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We are liars.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.